Okay, just I want to welcome everybody. What promises to be a the tech team is working. A fascinating evening. Just before we start, I just want to mention. I think you see the flyers. We have a couple upcoming programs next week. Our annual Tanakh Yom Iyun. I think we have really a wonderful group of speakers and some very interesting topics. And the following week, Rabbi Broyd will be speaking at the Beit, Innovation and Jewish Law. And the following week, where I don't have a flyer yet, March the 20th, Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon of Drop Katif will be speaking on the Haggadah. He actually just published a two-volume work on the Haggadah, Moser HaRav Kook, and it's going to be translated into English. The English translation should be ready by his trip. That's going to be on March 20th. And anybody who wants to come to Italy or Central Europe in the summer, let us know. The Italian trip is close to sold out. So if you want to come, we're not quite sold out, but if you want to come, you should move quickly. This was really, our trip last year was really a wonderful trip. It's a wonderful opportunity, and you'll get about a third of it back in a tax receipt. We offer, the way it works out, about a third of the price will be worked for a receipt if you live in Canada. The Americans don't get that, you know, benefit. But okay, that's it for that, and pleasure to see everybody. It's a pleasure to introduce our evening speaker. Dr. Sturman has a PhD in physics. We were in NYU together. He went on to do his graduate work at Columbia, did his PhD at Hebrew U. He's been living in Efrat for 25 years. He's been living in Israel for 25 years. I've been here in Efrat for 25 years. 23 years in Efrat, 7 children, I think 2 of whom are in the Army now.
Two
have finished the Army. He's making a bar mitzvah in Shavuos HaGadol. That's the important stuff. And he works as a physicist, but why he's here tonight is because he is really one of the people, the reasons I wear Tchelet, and the people who are wearing Tchelet. He is really involved as the founding member of the Betil Tchelet Association, and he's spent many, many years researching Tchelet. It's a fascinating topic, and tonight he's going to give us the history, the lost and found of Tchelet. And without further ado, Rav Baruch, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I can't express my gratitude to Rabbi Kelman and to the entire community of Toronto. It's been a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos. So hospitable and so warm and wonderful. So thank you very much. The way it's going to go tonight, if it works, I don't know what the logistics will actually happen. I have some pictures and slides, but much more important, regardless of whether we get the slides up and running, I hope to do the dying with you. It won't work exactly as it should because we'll be missing something that's the sun, and I'll talk about that. That's a major part of our discussion this evening. But we should be able to get something, hopefully working. So the mitzvah of Tchelet, today, in this week's parsha, we read, for the first time in the Torah, we read the word Tchelet in the context of the Mishkan, in the context of the tabernacle that was created for a house of God, and of course the Beis HaMikdash was also Tchelet was a very, very important part of that. But what we know Tchelet from probably mostly is from what we say every single day. V'natnu al tzitzit hakanaf petil tchelet. Every Jew is commanded to affix a thread of tchelet onto his garment. And why do we do that? Well, it's simply stated, Uritem oto uzchartem et kol mitzvot Hashem. You will look at it and you will remember all of the mitzvot, all of the commandments in the Torah. So this is an important one, right? There aren't all that many things that are written in the Torah where it says, and you will use this as a reminder of all of the mitzvot in the Torah. It's pretty big and important, an important commandment. How does it work? What's the logistics of that? How exactly does it work that you'll look at them and remember all of the mitzvot in the Torah? What did you learn when you were growing up? What's the Rashi say? That's okay. So no, you're getting mixed up. That's not Rashi. That's not Rashi. Rashi has another understanding of how you look at the tzitzis and you remember all of the mitzvot in the Torah. It has to do with the gematria of the word tzitzis. You remember? Tzitzis adds up to 600. And then you add your five knots and your eight strings, 613, voila. There's a problem with that, though. First of all, tzitzis in the Torah is spelled without one of the yuds, so it adds up to 590. The second problem is not everybody agrees that you have eight strings. In fact, Beit Hillel says you only have six strings. And not everybody agrees that you have five knots. There are many, many shitot that don't have any knots or have 13 knots or all kinds of other in-between ranges. So this is a very strange reason that why is it that the Torah would tell you, and two times a day we read, and two times a day we read the idea that you do this and you'll remember all of the mitzvot in the Torah and the whole basis is this kind of a little precarious gematria. Very strange. Rav Meir is the one exactly who says differently, and that's brought down by the Ramban. And in fact, for anybody here who knows Hebrew well, it doesn't make sense to say that Uritem Oto is talking about the tzitzit. Because you wouldn't say Oto then. What would you say? You'd say Uritem Otam, right? You look at them. So what is it that Oto must be referring to? It in masculine, singular? The petil techelet, the string of techelet. And that's what the pshat has to be. You look at the string of the techelet and you'll remember all the mitzvot of the Torah. And that works, according to the Ramban, by looking at it, it looks like the color of the sky. You look at the color of the sky, it reminds you of God who lives in the heavens, and that will remind you of all of the mitzvot in the Torah. And even that, however, is probably not the pshat in the pasuk. Because I think that the pshat is it comes from the fact that, really, of what we read today. Okay, and this is based on Professor Milgram, Olav HaShalom's ideas, which are that the Tchelet was used in as the Big Day Kehuna. We'll read this week in Parshat Tetzaveh, all of the Big Day Kehuna, all of the garments of the high priest and of the priest. The high priest wore all of these extra bigadim, eight extra garments. One of them was a me'il, an apron that was all techelet. Most of his clothes, most of them had techelet in them. The everyday kohen, the kohen hedyot, wore a belt that was made of techelet. Okay? So if you have the kohen gadol who's wearing a full suit of this precious techelet, and you have a kohen hedyot, a regular kohen who's wearing a belt, a sash of tchelet, and comes along the everyday Jew and wears one string of tchelet. So in essence, what happens here is that the tchelet that one wears on his garment, on his beged, is essentially his bigdei kehuna. The everyday Jew wears a uniform in the service of God, just like the Kohen does, and just like the Kohen Gadol does. The Kohen Gadol has a large amount of things that he has to do in his service. The Kohen Hedyot, less, but still quite a number of mitzvot that he has to do. And the everyday Jew, in his service of God, also has a uniform, and that uniform reminds him of his duties. What are the duties of the everyday Jew? To keep the mitzvot. To do all of the mitzvot in the Torah, and that's how you'll look at the Petil Techelet, and you'll remember all of the mitzvot in the Torah. Okay. That's small. Yeah, I guess you should move it. Okay. 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 Why was techelet used? I'm using this word again and again, techelet. But what was it? The only There's no description of what Tchelet was in Tanakh. It's assumed that everybody knew what Tchelet was. And just like there's no description of where gold comes from, right? There's no description of Nechoshet, of Kesef, of anything else. These were commodities that anybody in the ancient world knew what they were. And the reason that everybody knew what Tchelet was because it was the most precious commodity in the ancient world. And in fact, the word Tchelet predates the written Torah. The first mention that we have in recorded historical documents comes from the Tel El Amarna letters. This is, anybody here a historian that's going to keep me honest? Because I can say whatever I want. We're talking about around the time of Avraham Avinu, right? Maybe 1500 BC, 1500 BC is when you're talking about for the Tel El Amarna letters. This is a list of gifts that were brought from the king of the Mitanni, which is in northern Syria, down to the Egyptian prince. Dzrada married off his daughter to the pharaoh, the prince, and brought some important gifts down with him. And there's a list of all the different things that were brought. Very precious things, beautiful gifts, beautiful articles, beautiful cloths, and so on. And one of those things that was brought, the Tel El Amarna letters, it's phenomenal where they were found. They were found in the late 1800s by a lady in Luxor who was digging up her garden and using this very, very rich soil as fertilizer. And it ends up that the fertilizer that she was using were these tablets that are 15, you know, what are we talking about? 1500 BC. These are, you know, 3,500 years old. And somebody said that's probably not the best use for those tablets. Anyway, so these Tel El Amarna letters, in it, we have the words Subatu Satakilti, and in fact also Argamanu. So Takilti, the word, the first time that it's used, even predates the Torah, at least the written Torah, and again, that's why the Torah doesn't need to talk about it. It's an obvious commodity. Everybody knows what it is. What was it? It was a precious dye that came from a shellfish. Now, I'm saying this right now, and I'm kind of jumping the gun, because we're going to find out that not everybody agrees with this, and not everybody knew it. But looking back now, it's hard to tell the story, because what we know now will tell us a little bit about what was going on in the ancient world, but then it was lost, and nobody knew about it. But so you have to kind of stay with me if you can keep the mystery. But these shellfish, already 200-300 years before this, had been discovered on the island of Crete by the Minoans. And they were probably the first that came up with the idea that you could actually use these shellfish to create dyes, and those dyes gave you a dye in the purple-blue range. More purple, a little bit red, more blue. But this was, once they discovered this, it was taken over by the Phoenicians a few hundred years later, and it became essentially the commodity of value in the ancient world. I could say almost in a very, very general sense, but certainly in the Mediterranean world. At one point, it was worth its weight in gold. It was worth 20 times its weight in gold. Why is it so beautiful and so important? Why is it so important? Because if you think back in the ancient times, it's very hard to find anything with color, let alone a dye. Okay, so you can find rocks. We were talking about lapis lazuli. You can find rocks that have color in them, but they're not a dye. The difference between something with color and a dye is that a dye has to be able to get into a fabric and stay there and stay beautiful, right? So if I take, you know, really beautiful wine and pour it on my shirt, it'll make a stain. It may even look red for a little bit, but if I take it and I wash it off, the stain may remain, it may look dirty, but it's not a dye. To have something that has a beautiful color that stays fast inside of a fabric is a very, very rare thing. We'll talk about it, why chemically it's so difficult to achieve. But in the ancient world, there were no colors. You had whatever the sheep or the cow gave you, and that was basically the end of it. You had grays, and you had maybe a little bit of browns and so on, but you didn't have any dyes and any colors that were available. So when the ancients discovered these purple and blue dyes, they took the world by storm. It was the absolute height of fashion and was something that was phenomenally expensive. And anything that's expensive, along with it comes status, wealth, power, influence, money, and a lot of greed. And so everybody who came into contact with these beautiful shellfish purple and blue dyes wanted them, and people who could wanted to control them. And so we find that wars were fought over who would control the industry of Tchelet and Argaman. Possibly even the war of Devorah was fought over this, right? Because if you think about it, what is Aim Sisera? Remember Sisera, the bad enemy? What is she waiting for when her son is going to come back? Remember, she's waiting for the Shalal Tzva'im Rikma, the beautiful colored cloth that her husband is going to bring back from the coast where he went to fight. The people who were involved in the fight were the northern tribes, and the northern tribes traditionally were the ones that were involved in the dying, because it all happened along the coast. So the war is Nebuchadnezzar, when he destroyed Eretz Yisrael. According to the Medrash, he left the Chilazon catchers in Eretz Yisrael. When Alexander the Great went to Persia and saw these colors for the first time, he fell in love with them, and he brought them back to Greece. The Greeks absolutely went crazy over these colors, and eventually Julius Caesar is known because he wore the toga purpurei, right, where he had his own toga, which was made out of purple, and a beautiful gold band around it. When the Romans came to power, they not only fell in love with this dye, but they started restricting the use on the dye. And here is really where the story starts to get interesting, because ultimately you got to ask the question. I just told you, and you know, every single day we talk about this Tchelet, and Tchelet is so important, and it's all the mitzvahs in the Torah, and it's such a beautiful mitzvah, and it's so important, such a fundamental idea. Where did it go? Can you imagine that tefillin would be lost to the Jewish people? Can you imagine that, I don't know, even something like an esrog or matzah or something like that? These are the fundamental things of our Jewish life, and those are things which happen, you know, in one or two times during the year. Tzitzis, I mean, we wear it every single day. People wore this tefillin. So where did it go? How could it possibly get lost? And the answer is based on this fact that it was so expensive, it was so valuable, and so desired that it became restricted, and that's where things start to get a little bit difficult. Tyre, I'll just show you this one picture here. Tyre, Tzur. You have to read from Yechezkel. There's a beautiful description of Tyre, which was the capital of Phoenicia. And they were the ones who really put Tchelet on the map. They were the Tchelet dealers in the ancient world. Fine embroidered linen from Egypt was your sail and served as your banner. This is Yechezkel. Your awnings were of Tchelet and Argaman from the coasts of Elisha. You boasted, O Tyre, I am perfect in beauty. And Yechezkel goes on to talk about how God will strike them down for their haughtiness. But the ideal here was the idea that the Tyrians were the Tchelet's manufacturers. There's a myth in Tyre on how Tchelet was discovered. How was it that anybody discovered this purple shellfish that could give this beautiful dye? And the myth was that Hercules, who was called Melkarth in Tyre, was walking along the shores of the Mediterranean and wondering what kind of a gift he could give to the nymph of Tyre, when his dog came up to him all bloody in the mouth. And he looked at the dog and realized it wasn't blood at all. It was a beautiful purple on the dog's mouth. And he took his dog, his dog showed him this snail that he had bitten into. And supposedly that was the myth of how the purple shellfish dye was discovered. This coin from Tyre, again, you can't see it so well, but there's a picture here of a dog and a mirror. And this is from Tyre. This is about 100 CE, this coin. So it's about 2,000 years old. In any event, so we were up to the Romans. The Romans start constraining the use of Techelet and Argaman. Only the royal families are allowed to use Techelet and Argaman. And only the royal dye houses are allowed to produce it. The Romans went nuts over purple. And porphyrogenesis is a word that's actually still used. It means born into the purple. I guess it's what people would call today born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Because the emperors in the late Roman times and Byzantine times would have a special room of purple where the mother of the new emperor would go to give birth to the new emperor. And that's what it meant to be born into the purple. You could petition the emperor to see him and talk to him and give gifts to him. And that was called in ancient Roman times as adoring the purple, right? Bringing gifts to the emperor. At one point, the Emperor Theodosius writes that it is usur for anybody to deal in Tchelet and Argaman. I'll quote from the edict. If I can find it. The edict, we're talking about 486. Here it is. The Emperor Theodosius writes, all persons of whatever sex, rank, skill, profession, or family shall abstain from the possession of that kind of material which is dedicated only to the emperor and his household, nor shall any person at his home weave or make silk cloths or tunics which have been colored with a purple dye and woven with the admixture of anything else. Men shall bring forth from their homes and deliver the tunics and cloaks that are dyed in all parts of their texture with the blood of purple shellfish. No threads dyed with purple dye shall be interwoven, yada, yada, yada. And then he says, there's no reason why any man should complain of having been deprived of the price, because it shall suffice that he obtains impunity for the violation of the law that he trampled underfoot. But let no man now, by such concealment, incur the peril or the toils of the new constitution. Otherwise he shall sustain the danger of involvement in a crime similar to that of high treason. I.e., if you wear tchelet, you will be killed. And that's a very, very difficult thing for the Jews in Roman times in Israel. Because in the times of the Talmud, it became exceedingly difficult and expensive for an impoverished Jewish community to wear tchelet. It was very rare, it was very hard to come by, and it was dangerous. And it was dangerous. There's a story in the Gemara. Sure. I'll talk about Kaliyu in a second. I'll talk about Kaliyu in a second. There is a story in the Gemara, in Talmud Bavli Sanhedrin, about two students who came from Tveria or Rakach, and they went to Babel, to Babylonia, and in their possession was Techelet. They were almost caught by the eagle, says the Gemara, ubenes nitzlu, and they were able to escape by a miracle. So, what does this mean? What happened here? That even though it was difficult, and even though it was dangerous, Jews were smuggling tchelet from Eretz Israel to Bavel, and risking their lives to do so. They were almost caught by the eagle. The eagle is Rome. The eagle is a symbol of Rome. They were miraculously saved, but at least that means, one of two things. Either A, they were miraculously saved, but not everybody was, or B, even though they were miraculously saved, they were at least risking their lives. So Jews risked their lives to wear tchelet, even though there were these edicts against them. This is a fascinating coin in the context of that story. It's a Roman coin with an eagle, right? That's the symbol of Rome. And between the legs and talons of the eagle, you can see a murex shell. You can see the shell. It's right here. So I'm giving things away because I'm talking here like we know that this is a murex and it's a shell and everything. So step back for a second, okay? Because let me talk for a second about Kala Ilan. In the times of the Torah, in the times of the Gemara, there was a fraudulent dye that was being used. Tchelet was so expensive, right, that it would be great if you could find some alternative that was cheap. And in fact, there was an alternative that was cheap. It was called Kala Ilan indigo, and it was exactly the same color as tchelet. Only God could tell, says the Gemara, the difference between somebody who was wearing real tchelet and somebody who was wearing fake tchelet, and fake tchelet kala ilan, which comes from a vegetable source, from a tree of some sort, that was not allowed for real tchelet. And the worry was twofold. If somebody is selling tchelet and selling it for the price of real tchelet, so that's a crooked business deal, and that was one of the problems that the Chachamim had. But there was a much more important problem. Because if you wear real live tchelet from the true source, the chilazon, then you can wear that together with linen. Tchelet is wool. You are allowed to wear it on a linen beged, and you know, of course, that linen and wool together are not allowed from the Torah except in the Bigdei Kehuna and except in tzitzit in tchelet. That's shatnez in general. But when you have real live tchelet, you're allowed to wear shatnez. When you're wearing kala ilan, you're not allowed to. And therefore, if you have fake tchelet, you're going to not only be paying a lot more for it, but you're going to be doing worse. You could possibly be over a serious violation. Listen, that's a very, very good question. And the answer has to do with the fact that how much... what would happen if you brought home a cubic zirconium ring to your... to your wife, or a diamond that was made in a laboratory, right? There is such a thing as authenticity, right? And you pay for that. The authentic dye was considered the dye from the shellfish, and that's not only in the Jewish world, but obviously in the non-Jewish world too. And the edicts were not against wearing kala ilan, but they were against wearing the authentic, at least what the Romans and the Greeks considered the authentic, and the Torah and the Chachamim as well. Ah. Yes, that's true. I guess you would have to say it's not real tchelet. It's in any event, where does kala ilan come from? It comes from the indigo plant. Rav Herzog, who we'll talk about in a second, I'm sorry, we have to move along. Rav Herzog, who we'll talk about in a second, suggests that the term kala ilan comes from the ancient Chinese kitlan, and that's a symbol for indigo in Chinese. Kitlan, kala ilan. Herzog suggests that may be where it came from. Indigo originally came from India. That's why it was called indigo in India and China. And when it came to the Mediterranean world, just around the time of the Mishnah, let's say, you know, around the time of the turn of the millennium, then it became a big problem for the Jews, but it's going to be very, very important to us, and we'll see why in a second. Let's move fast forward. Around the year 620, when the land of Israel was destroyed by the Byzantines. How did it work? The Byzantines took over. No. The Sassanids, in around 618, captured Israel and took the true cross from Jerusalem back to Persia. The Byzantines came and captured it back like a year or two later. And then, of course, in 620, the Arabs captured and destroyed Israel for one final time. So in the span of this 10 years, Jerusalem and Israel is captured back and forth a number of times. There was one thing that every single invading army had in common, and that was that they tried as best as they could to wipe out the Jews at each time. So this was probably one of the most devastating centuries for the Jews in Eretz Israel and in that part of the world. And during that time, and especially when the Arabs came over and anything that was associated with the Romans destroyed, they destroyed all of the dye houses, wiped out the purple shellfish dyeing all along the coast systematically as they moved down and all the way up eventually until Constantinople, wiped out all of the purple dyeing industries. The Jews could not succeed in keeping the tradition beyond that time. And we can understand why. It was only the Jews in Eretz Israel that knew about it. You needed the snails in Eretz Israel. And so Tchelet was lost around the year 600, 620. Around 700, the Medrash already says, V'achshav ein lanu ela lavan sha'tchelet nignaz. There is no longer Tchelet around, only white. And that was it for Tchelet. For the next 1,300 years, Jews had no idea not only what Tchelet was, and certainly not only what the source was, what this chilazon was all about, and how to die with it even if they could find this chilazon. They didn't even know what the color was. And there were various traditions. Somebody asked me today, why does Rashi say that Tchelet is green? And there are people that say that Tchelet was purple. And there are people that say Tchelet was dark blue and light blue. And what color was Tchelet? All of these things were completely, completely lost to the Jewish people. And not only to the Jewish people, but to the world in general. This idea, which was so important to the ancients and such an important commodity, was completely lost to the entire world, the entire Western world. And that's where the story, I guess, would have ended. But now we can fast forward a little bit to the 1800s, the middle of the 1800s, when the stirrings of Zionism are starting to rustle in the air. And one of the issues that came up was the question of, well, what are the religious Jews going to do when they actually come back to Israel? Well, of course, the purpose of coming back to Israel is building a Beis HaMikdash, right? And then when you build the temple, then the purpose there is to do the Avodah, the Beis HaMikdash, to have the Karbanot, the sacrifices and all of that. But there's one little problem, and this was pointed out. According to the Halacha, you can't do any of the sacrifices, you can't offer any of the sacrifices if you don't have the vestments, the garments of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And those were made out of Tchelet. So if you don't have Tchelet, you can't have the garments of the high priest. If you don't have the garments of the high priest, you can't do the service in the temple. If you don't have the temple, what's the point of all of this Zionism? And this was a very important issue for many of the Jews that were thinking about it. And the answer was confronted by the Tiferet Yisrael, and he answers, no, it's fine. What you need is a dye that has the right color of Tchelet. In his opinion, that was sky blue. Sky blue color is all you need, as long as it's a very fast and lasting dye. And if you have that, that's good enough. You don't need anything else. So what he did is he basically took the problem and he said, I don't know the solution to the problem, but I know how you can solve the problem. Go to your laboratories, go find a good blue dye that has the right color and it's nice and lasting, and then we'll solve the problem. Now it's a practical issue. It's no longer a theoretical obstacle. And this was accepted until a young Hasidic brilliant upstart wrote a book on Sidrei Taharot when he was 18 years old. And in that book, he argues with the Tiferet Yisrael, and he says that Tiferet Yisrael is missing a fundamental source from the Gemara Menachot, which is absolutely incontrovertible, which says, Tchelet min achilazon kasher, shelo min achilazon asur. Tchelet has to come from the specific chilazon. This young Hasidic rabbi was named Gershon Henoch Leiner. Is there a Leiner? I must talk to you afterwards. Gershon Henoch Leiner was the Radziner Rebbe. The Radziner Rebbe's grandfather was the Mei Shiloach, Mordechai Yosef of Ishbitz, who was the famous student of the Kutzker Rebbe, and probably the cause of the Kutzker Rebbe's famous nervous breakdown where he secluded himself in a room for the next 20 years. When Mordechai Yosef decided that it was time for him to leave, and he left the Kutzker Rebbe, the Kutzker Rebbe couldn't handle it. And those stories are phenomenally interesting. In any event, Mordechai Yosef's grandson, the Radziner Rebbe, was a fascinating individual. He taught himself, self-taught, because of course the Hasidish Rebbe is not going to go to school to learn this stuff. He not only knew everything that there was to know about Judaism and Halacha and Gemara and Zohar and all of those, but he studied pharmacology, he studied engineering, he built a flour mill that produced something like 20,000 tons of flour every week or something like that. Tremendous. I mean, can you imagine a Hasid Sharebi who's an engineer like that? In any event, I believe that the Radziner Rebbe had this major guilt feeling. And imagine for a second, I talked about it last night. Imagine the young Radziner Rebbe who looks during the day at what he's written in his book and he says, oh, I got the Tver Yisrael, right? Because he forgot that Gemara and he forgot that Tosefta and now I prove that he was wrong. But then when he went to sleep that night, I guess he couldn't go to sleep. He couldn't sleep. Because you know what he really just did, and he probably realized it afterwards? He just destroyed all hope of building the Beit HaMikdash. He just took away the opportunity, at least on a theoretical level, for the Jews to come back to Israel and establish a state, and this was too much for him to bear. But what's he going to do? He was an Ish Emet. He was a man who wanted and needed to have truth. And the Radziner Rebbe, who just decided that the only possible way to bring back Mashiach, to bring Mashiach, to build the Beit HaMikdash, to reestablish a Jewish sovereignty, is dependent on this chilazon, this creature that we don't even know what it is. No, I don't know about that Rashi. But I can tell you one thing. The Radziner did not wait for anything to come from Shamayim. He didn't wait for chilazon to drop for Shamayim or anything else. And what he did is in 1889, he picked himself up, studied Italian first, and went to the newly formed aquarium in Naples, where he says in his book, he writes, and there, behind these walls of glass, all of the creatures of the sea roam freely. And he studied them for a year, looking at every sea creature that was known at the time, at least in the Mediterranean, to figure out what is the chilazon. Because if he's decided that you need a chilazon, then the only option for him is to go find chilazon. He knew about the snail, but he was biased against it. And that was because years before, a Hebraicist named Gesenius had written about Tehillah. This is a Christian Hebrew scholar who, in his entry on Tehillah in his dictionary, writes, it comes from a snail, but it's purple-blue, because the snail produces a purple-blue. The Tiferet Yisrael also knew about Gesenius' work, and he writes, I have to disagree with the master Gesenius, because Tehillah is sky-blue. And as long as we're looking for something which is sky-blue, we can't look at the snail, because the snail gives you a purple-blue, and that's not what Tehillah is. And the Radziner also knew about this, and that's why he rejected this. I didn't even look at the snail. And he went on to discover something else. I have, let's see if this will work. This is exactly what the Radziner found. A cuttlefish called Sepia officinalis. It's a beautiful little creature. Let's see if this is going to work. I don't know. This is the cuttlefish. The little fish comes from the squid family, and it's just an amazing little guy. It can change color, it can change texture like an octopus. Kind of swims around or little like walking around, and it's got these beautiful tentacles and sucks up its fish. It's a wonderful little creature. So that was what the Radziner believed was the source of Tchelet. But the point is that the ink that the squid gives off is black, and Tchelet has to be blue. So what do you do about that? Well, that is certainly no problem for the Radziner. Now that he's found the chilazon, to make the black ink blue is just a matter of finding the right things to add, and then he did. He came back to Radzin by 1891. 20,000 Hasidim all over Poland are wearing his Tchelet. Huge controversy within the Jewish world. People were against the Radziner. People were for the Radziner. This is real Tchelet. It's the worst thing that could possibly be. In Eretz Yisrael, the argument gets to the point where Hillel Meshel Gelbstein, who was a Kutzker Chassid who ends up in the middle of Yerushalayim in the late 1800s, he gets up and he burns the talis of Rav Schlesinger, who was wearing the Tchelet in the middle of the Churva synagogue in Yerushalayim. And that's what was going on with the machloket between the Radziners.
So if the Tchelet gives off a black ink, on what basis did he feel that this was the correct ink?
Because he was able to get it to become a blue dye.
But you could probably do that with other
animals. Hold on for a second to that. Okay. This is the Radziner, and the Radziner is the greatest of greats. Okay, so now we have a Tchelet, which most Rabbanim disagree with and didn't accept. Fast forward a few years later to 1914, and Rev Herzog. Rev Herzog was the chief rabbi in Dublin, in Ireland, and one of these brilliant men. At least 10 languages he spoke. He got his graduate degrees, in fact, in mathematics, in law, in classics, and then he went on to get his doctorate, and in 1914 he got his doctorate for the University of London at Leeds in Hebrew porphyrology, or the study of purple in ancient Israel. And his doctorate was on Tchelet. And in his doctorate on Tchelet, he tries to investigate the Radzin. Part of his doctorate is, well, what's going on with these Radziners and what's exactly happening? And he sent off to the dye masters of Radzin and asked them, can you send me samples? The Radziner Rebbe died. He died very, very young. He died in 1891. And so this is 1914, 25 years later. And the Radziner was no longer around. But the dye was still around, the dye masters were still around, and they sent him a sample of their strings, which Rav Herzog then took and sent to his friend Paul Friedlander, a chemist in Germany. And Paul Friedlander was the one to do the research, because he had just described the molecule dibromo indigo, which was the molecule of Tyrian purple that came from a shellfish, and it was the purple dye that was used in the ancient times, and he had discovered what the exact molecular structure was. Paul Friedlander took one look at these strings, and he writes back the very strange words to Rav Herzog, this is not an organic dye. It is an inorganic material, and it's called Prussian blue. Prussian blue was invented in 1704 by an artist named Diesbach, and it's based on a compound of iron and carbon. It's basically an iron cyanide type of a compound. Well, Rav Herzog couldn't believe it. What do you mean inorganic? It comes from the squid. What are you going to tell me now that the Radziner Rebbe doesn't? What's going on here? What's happening? So he sent away to the dye masters at Radzin and asked for their recipe. And they write back the recipe. And there they say in beautiful Hasidic language, you can imagine a recipe, a chemistry recipe written in Yiddish. And they tell him, what we do is we take the black ink of the squid, which is the only thing that has color, and we add to it colorless chemicals, and the Gemara says that you add chemicals, so it wasn't surprising that you had to add chemicals, right? We add to it colorless chemicals, because I guess they were worried that, you know, you might think that it was coming from anything. The color had to come from the black squid ink. And all you wanted to do, according to the Radziners, was to draw out the blue from that black, right? And you add these colorless things, potash, a little bit of iron, and you put it in a cauldron, and you heat it, as they say, inside and out until the flames of Gehenna cover the cauldron. And then what comes out are these crystals of blue, and they can form the dye. Well, Rav Herzog understood is that this, in fact, the color, which they thought had everything to do with the squid, in fact had nothing to do with the squid. The organic carbon and nitrogen is completely dissociated at those high temperatures, reforms together with the iron, forms a ferric ferrocyanide, and essentially what they're doing is synthesizing Prussian blue. This is something that Rav Herzog absolutely rejected, because he couldn't believe that the source, the chilazon, which is so important, would play no part, actually, at the end of the day, in the dyeing, and you could have used just as easily ox blood as Diesbach did, or chopped liver or gefilte fish and everything, and we've gotten the same thing. So Rav Herzog absolutely and categorically rejected Radzin Tchelet, and just as one interesting side note, when Radzin was destroyed during the Holocaust, the remnants of Radzin that made their way to Eretz Yisrael after the war wanted to reestablish the dyeing of Tchelet, but they didn't know how. So they went to Rav Herzog after the war and they asked him if he could share the correspondence that he had in those early days of the 1900s, if they could share that correspondence with them. And Rav Herzog brought out his letters, gave them the testimony of how exactly to make Tchelet according to the Radziners, and essentially saved the process from destruction. So Rav Herzog is at the same time responsible for completely discrediting Radzin Tchelet, and at the same time saving their process from historical obliteration.
Why would he give them something that he knows?
Because he was a great man, and he said, I don't believe that this is real Tchelet, but I can give edut, I can give testimony that this is what I got from Radzin. It's a very, very special man who can do something like that. Okay. It's not listening either if you tell anybody exactly what you're doing. He said, I think this is wrong, but this is what you want. Here it is. Should I start the dying? Because what I want to do is I want to end the story. I'm just trying to be aware a little bit of the time, and I want to leave some time for questions. I'm going to tell the next stage in the story, and then I'm going to get to the dying. That's an excellent question, and you're leading me in. It's like you set me up. So I've been talking now about blue and purple and purple and blue and blue and shellfish, and the purple comes from the shellfish, and the blue comes from the shellfish. Rav Herzog knew about Gesenius' work, certainly, but he also knew about the archaeology. In the late 1800s, the Holy Land was crisscrossed with all of these archaeologists from England and from other places that were starting to investigate what was going on in the land of Israel and along the coasts. And there they found evidence of this shellfish dyeing, entire mounds of murex crushed that were clearly used for some kind of an industry, and it was a dyeing industry. In the mid-1800s, Lacaze Dutte, who was a zoologist, was on a boat, and a fisherman broke open a shell and smeared his shirt with it, and it turned to a beautiful purple. Lacaze Dutte immediately realized that this must have been the Tyrian purple of the ancient times, and he studied, he made his career out of the discovery. He found that in the Mediterranean, there are three types of snails that can give a dye. I'll pass them around or you can come up to look at them afterwards. The three are Theus hemostoma, which has a red mouth, hemostoma, right? There's another one, which is called Murex brandaris, very spiny and sharp. Beautiful, beautiful snail. I'm looking at the shells, of course, not the snails. The snails are a worm that live inside the shell, of course. These shells don't have any residence right now. And then there was another snail called the Murex trunculus. Now, what they found, and what Lacazette found, and Paul Friedlander afterwards as a chemist who started researching this, is that these two, Murex brandaris and Theus hemostoma, can give you a red-purple dye, whereas Murex trunculus will give you a purple-blue dye. And in the archaeological finds all over Tyre and Byblos and Sarepta and even Dora and other places, there were always two mounds that were found. One mound of crushed hemostoma and brandaris, and another mound of Murex trunculus. And so, within the secular world, essentially the position that was put forth and absolutely accepted by all scholars and historians and chemists was that red-purple that came from the brandaris and the hemostoma was argaman, and blue-purple that came from the trunculus was tehelet. And everybody accepted that, but Rav Herzog couldn't. And Rav Herzog had this problem. He said, and it took a Rav Herzog, really, to know secular scholarship so well, and really he does, and yet to be strong enough to reject it, even though he was going against an absolute unanimous verdict by all scholars. He said, I can't accept the fact that the trunculus is tchelet, is the source, the chilazon, and that what it gives is real tchelet, because our tradition says tchelet is sky blue, and if it's purple blue, that is not acceptable. And therefore, Rav Herzog was never able to get around this problem, and he died in 1959. Without ever having solved the problem of tchelet. He says all of the archaeological evidence points at the Murex trunculus, but if it gives you the wrong color, purple-blue, if there's any hint of violet, says Rav Herzog, that is enough to move tchelet away from the idea that this is the source of tchelet, and we have to say that it's something else. He suggested some others, nothing really, it was just kind of conjecture and maybe wishful thinking. Nothing else dyes anything. These are the only snails that you can find in the Mediterranean. These are the only snails that have any kind of archaeological evidence. And that would have been the end of the story, if not for an absolutely serendipitous discovery by a chemist at the Shenkar College of Fibers in the late 70s and early 80s. His name was Otto Elsner. Professor Elsner was brought onto the job of investigating tcheles by a very, very wealthy chemist named Sidney Edelstein. It's always money at the end of the day. It's always the donors. If you want to know how to get something done, talk to the donors. And that's what happened. Sidney Edelstein was a chemist who made his huge fortunes by inventing an alternative to mosquito netting that he sold to the U.S. Army in World War II. And he was always interested in dyeing. Yigal Yadin found a tuft of wool on Masada, in the caves next to Masada. And he wanted it investigated to see what it was made out of, and he sent it to Sidney Edelstein. And Edelstein looked at it and he said, this is indigo, it's not, there's no derivatives that come from any kind of a shellfish, so it's not real tchelet. But that got Sidney Edelstein thinking, what is real tchelet? So he came to the Shenkar College and he said, I'll fund the research to find out what tchelet is all about and this ancient purple dyeing. And of course, he believed about the trunculus and the purple blue. It must have been the tchelet. He was completely, he bought the whole line of the secular scholarship completely. And he also went to the University of Haifa and put some money down there for a grant for the Maritime Institute there. And he got Ehud Spanier, who was a marine biologist, and between Elsner and Spanier, they started investigating all this. But there's Israeli chutzpah for you, because what happens is that Elsner was requested by his colleagues to do the dyeing outside because of the smell, and I hope that we'll all experience in a few minutes that wonderful experience of the smell of shellfish dyeing. And he was asked to move his research out to the parking lot. And there, Elsner found that just as expected, just as everyone had said since the time of Gesenius, the Murex trunculus, when you dyed with it, it gave you a purple-blue dye. But that was only on cloudy days. On sunny days, the Murex trunculus gave you a perfect sky blue color. And that, Otto Elsner found, was the solution to the problem. And Rav Herzog had been right all along. It was blue, it was sky blue, and it did come from the Murex trunculus. Rav Herzog, unfortunately, didn't live to see this result. And that was essentially the end of the story. And once that happened, it was just a matter of time until the religious community got a hold of it. And that happened through the work of Professor Zeiderman, Dr. Zeiderman, and also the work especially of Eliyahu Tevger, who is the mentor, and the rest of it is, as they say, you know, that's where we come into the story. But we're going to take a little break now, and we're going to do the dying. I hope that the water is really hot. I had coffee before and it wasn't. So. Okay, so you know what? Let's watch another movie. This is how you get the gland out of the snail. This is me. Many years ago, and next to me is Professor, I don't know if you'll see him at all, Professor Roald Hoffman, those are his fingers. He's a Nobel Prize winning chemist. That's his finger. We're breaking open the snail and extracting that yellow part on the bottom of the worm, which is the gland. It's called the hypobranchial gland, and it's part of the digestive system of the snail. What is the snail doing with this dye? Fascinating question. Some interesting research going on now that has some suggestions for that. You slice off the gland, and that's it. That's all you need from the entire snail. All of the dye that we need is there. You need about 60 snails to make 4 strings of tchelet. The snail is alive. The snail has to be alive. And that's something that we know both from the ancient scholars Pliny and Aristotle, and also from the Gemara. The Gemara says that the snail has to be alive. I'll talk about why in a second. Okay. So what we're going to do now, I'm going to hold it up, I guess, mostly. Those glands that were just extracted, as you saw from the snail, what we do with that is we take them, mush them up in a blender, and then put them on a plata, a Shabbos plata, for a day or two. And then they get dried out, hardened into sheets. And we take that and we put that into a coffee grinder. And voila, we have our instant nes-tchelet. Okay. And this tchelet that's ground up, how many snails are in here? Maybe, I don't know, 3, 4, 5? Not sure. Oh, yeah. This is, you know, a few snails. Anyway, what I have here is simply the glands dried and ground. And nothing else. Ground as in a coffee grounder. Once it's in this state, it's extremely, extremely stable, and it can last for years and years and years without refrigeration. And that's a very important point. A dye has to be stable. If not, it will eventually fade in sunlight. It'll eventually be able to be washed out. And therein is the problem. Okay, we'll talk about that. So I've got my snail gland, but in it, you saw I scooped out that snail, but there's a lot of other things in there. There's meat, there's bits of shell, there's protein, there's fat. So what do you do to get rid of protein and fat? If you have that in your drain, so you'd add Drano, which is caustic soda, and that's what I'm going to do. So what's going to happen now? Is we're adding this extremely, extremely strong base. And that's caustic soda. I'm going to add that to the snails. And then where's the hot water? And now we're going to add some hot water to this. I really hope it's nice and hot. Oh, yeah, it's pretty good. We'll save it for a couple of seconds while it does a little bit of dissolving of, again, of the fats and the meats and everything else. And all I want left is the dye. Okay. Now, I mentioned a number of times that it's not easy to make a dye because there's two contradictory things that have to happen in order for a dye to work. On the one hand, it's got to be nice and stable and inert so that it won't wash out or fade. It shouldn't wash out with water. It shouldn't wash out with soap or detergent. But that means that it doesn't bond. And if it doesn't bond to water or soap, then the odds are that it won't bond to the fibers of cloth. So the exact stability of a dye is what makes it so hard to work in the first place. If I have blue marbles and I put them on a shirt, you know, they'll probably stay blue for a million years, but they won't attach themselves to the shirt. So this is the trick that the ancients had to find. How do you get this dye, which is so stable and inert, how do you get it into the dye, into the fabric? And in order to do that, you have to make it water soluble. And in order to make it water soluble, you have to figure out how to trick the dye into forming a bond with water. That was what took the Minoans or whoever else it was all of their ingenuity to figure out how to do that. And until they figured that out, they weren't able to dye. The way that they did it in ancient times, and we have records, Pliny, Aristotle, right, on how to dye and how you could do these shellfish dyeing. And what they would do is they would ferment it over a small fire, 9 days on a small flame. And that's already found in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about that. Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda talks about how do you do this. Tchelet, Abaye asks Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Tchelet, how do you dye? And he says, we take the dam of the chilazon and we put it on a fire for a long time and then we wait for a little bit and we add a little bit of chemicals and so on and so forth. So they would do a fermentation process. We're going to do this in a different way because we're a little bit smarter in terms of chemistry. And we're going to do what's called reduction. And we're going to do that by adding a chemical, a very, very strong reducing agent called sodium dithionite. Is anybody here a chemist? So again, I can say whatever I want. Sodium dithionite, we can go into the chemistry of what we're trying to do here by reducing it. A lot of this chemistry was really not well understood, and certainly the natural fermentation, it was not understood as late as 1999. And still people didn't understand what was going on in the ancient world. A lot of this work was done by a retired engineer in England named John Edmonds, who opened up a little shack at the Children's Museum outside of London where he did his natural dyeing. He was a big buff of medieval England, and he wanted to show them how they did indigo dyeing. And we got in touch with him and we said, well, you know, you know how to do indigo dyeing according to natural methods. Maybe you could help us try to figure out what's going on with the snail dyeing. And he did, and he actually found a whole bunch of information, a very, very important information about what was going on in the fermentation process that nobody had known before. So a lot of these discoveries were done by amateurs in many, many ways. Okay, so now we've got a dye, we've got it reduced, it's going to form a bond with water because of the chemical charge after the reduction, and I need one more thing, because if I were to add wool to this right now, then the strong acid of the Drano would turn it into felt. It would start to dissolve the wool as well. So I'm going to bring the pH down from acid down a little bit more neutral. From base, I'm going to bring it down to be a little bit more neutral. And how do I do that? I add an acid. A lot of acids would work. You can use lemon juice, but we use ammonium sulfite and a little bit more water. Voila. This is now the Yorah, which is ready to take the wool. And what do you notice about it? What's the color? Look at it. Yellow. The top water. Not blue on the bottom.
White?
Yellow.
Yellow.
Now this color now is yellow because in solution, the indigo that's in here, the beautiful blue that Otto Elsner saw, was the result of the ultraviolet rays of the sun coming down and breaking the bromine bonds and turning it into pure indigo. Remember that we said something else was indigo. Kalailan. So the molecule in here, after being exposed to sunlight, is exactly the same molecule as the Kalailan, which explains exactly why the Gemara says that you can't tell the difference between them. You can't tell the difference between them because they're identical on a molecular level. So right now we're going to add the wool to this in its what's called its leuco state. Leuco comes from the word white or pale. And so the indigo now is in its leuco state. It's water soluble, and we would add the wool. If I were to have to make tzitzis now, if I was going to make this, from this time on, everything has to be done lishma for the express purpose of making tchelot. Everything that was done up until now, the snail catching, the gra, everything else, preparing the vat, that doesn't have to be done lishma. The wool being dipped does. We're not going to make real tzitzis out of this wool, so I don't have to worry about it. Okay, so now it's in here for a couple of seconds. And the fact that this is not the color of the dye is something that explains an interesting issue in the Gemara. The Gemara says in that Gemara Menachot that I quoted, Tchelet Hechit Tzivatu, how do you make Tchelet? So Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda says, what you do is you take this dam chilazon, you make it into the vat, you prepare it, and you get ready to dye. And when you want to know if it's ready, what you do is you take a little bit out and pour it into an eggshell, and then you dip your wool in the dye in the eggshell, and then you see if it's ready. So the question that people ask all along is, if you want to know if it's ready, why don't you just look at it? The answer is that you can't look at it because you don't know what color it is. When it's in this glucose state, you can't determine whether it's ready or not ready. So, again, the key to all of this that I've done now, everything that I've done now is just a matter of figuring out how to make this thing die. What Otto Elsner discovered is that in this state, and only in this state, if you expose it to sunlight, the dibromo indigo, the bromine atoms that are attached to the indigo molecule as they come out of the snail, which is what gives you the purple blue, those bonds will be broken, the bromine goes away, and what you're left with is just indigo, and that indigo will have the perfect, beautiful blue sky color. I'm going to leave this for one more second. I want to explain for a second. You know, we're working on, my wife and I are finishing up the last touches on a book. The book is called The Rarest Blue. And it's going to be out hopefully this fall. I hope everybody will buy it because there's a lot of interesting stuff in it that I haven't gotten to. And I hope it'll be out this fall, and I hope it'll be finished. So we haven't done it yet. Deadline is April 1st. One of the things that we do in the is we try to dig down. And there's a chapter on the biology of the snail. This Murex truncus is a fascinating little guy. And then there's a chapter on the chemistry of the dye. And there's some very, very interesting things that are going on here. And then there's a chapter. And this chapter, I have to say, is my favorite chapter. It's a very, very difficult chapter. But it's a chapter on the physics of blue. And blue is a very, very rare thing in nature. You don't notice it because if you look at the sky, you look at the sea, you look at water, you see blue all over the place. But it happens to be that blue is extremely, extremely rare. The world is made up of earth tones. And once in a while, you have a gemstone or something that's blue. But you don't have any fruits or foods that are blue. Blueberries are purple. Can you think of a blue food? You don't. You don't have blue foods. So again, a real perfect blue, sky blue, you don't have it. And the reason is, and this we talk about, and I have to say that I didn't understand it until I really, really started to research it. There's a physical reason that blue simply is so hard to make. Blue has to be made by the absorption of red-orange photons. Trust me on this. And there is no physical mechanism that absorbs red-orange photons. There's lots and lots of physical methods to absorb blue photons, and that'll give you red and the earth tones that are around. And there are a lot of other physical methods to absorb infrared, but there's nothing that absorbs red, except, as far as anyone knows, for one molecule, and that's the indigo molecule. Why the indigo molecule absorbs these red-orange photons is a mystery. That's not really a mystery. I hope we'll talk about it. At least we have some suggestions as to why it is. But it's because of a very, very, very special property of the indigo molecule. I remember a couple months ago there was a debate that I had with a Rav, and the Rav was saying, you know what? So this chilazon can't be the source of the tchilas. Can't be. So I said, well, you know, okay, but it gives you exactly the same color as this kala ilan, exactly the same indigo. And we were arguing back and forth, and he said to me, all right, so they'll find another molecule that gives you the color. And that got me started to thinking, and that's why I did all of this research. That's a very easy thing to say. You know, they'll find another molecule. In the meantime, there is no other molecule in the universe that actually absorbs this and can give you a blue. So it really is an extremely, extremely strange thing on every level that the snail decides that it wants to ingest bromine instead of chlorine, that the snail has and stores this stuff in the hypobronchial gland. And why does it do it? Why do the Murex snails do it? That the chemistry works just in such a way that it allows for this kind of dyeing with the vat and fermentation and the exact right bacteria that knows how to do this. And all the way down to this molecule of why it is. And it's really an amazing thing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us all of this physics and chemistry and biology just to make this beautiful tchelet color, which we're going to see now. And what happens now is the opposite of the reduction process is called oxidation. What we want to do now is we want to rebind the oxygen into the molecule. Once we do that, the molecule will become extremely stable again, not water soluble. It won't be able to be washed out, and it won't be able to fade. The only problem is, since we didn't have sunshine, most probably, if it works, we'll get a purple instead of a blue, but that's also important. Why didn't Rav Herzog know anything about, why didn't Rav Herzog discover the sunlight when he was doing his dying? Because there's no sun in Ireland, exactly. So what happens here, got something caught on the bottom of it. Re-exposed to air, so slowly, slowly it should now be able to start getting some sort of a color back to it, and doesn't work, I have pictures. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Why is it that it has to be woman or man? And what is it about the woman that makes it take? And the Ezekiel point talks about women.
No, it talks about linen as their sails. Chelet has to be wool. The Gemara says this didn't work. I'm actually extremely embarrassed. So, hold on 1 second. I'll just. You got to trust me on this. That's what usually happens. Why didn't this at all give us the color of anything? Maybe the water's not. That's a good one. Yeah. No. None of those. It should work. I don't know. Maybe the water wasn't hot enough. I don't know. That's all of the bits of shell and bits of of now this didn't come out anything. It came out nothing. Okay. I guess the snail was defective. Okay, in any event, wow, that was a shame. Anyway, wait, okay, you asked a question about the wool. You know what? I guess if you look at it, it's got a little bit of a bluish tint. Yeah, a little bit. Nah. It usually comes out much more beautiful. Okay. In any event, in order for the Tchelet molecule to bind, it has to be bound to wool. The Gemara knows about this. Tchelet Amrahi. Tchelet is made out of Tzemer. The basis of a very, very important halacha actually comes from the fact that Tchelet has to be wool. And that is, if Tchelet would work on linen, then you would be able to wear linen tzitzis on your linen cloth. And then there wouldn't be any problem with wearing wool and linen together. But that's not the case. The Gemara proves that you have to be able to wear tzitzis of a linen cloth together with wool, because the only way tchelet works is on wool, and that's actually the way it works in terms of the chemical properties. It doesn't bind to linen. No. No. And in fact, you know what happens to indigo on cotton. That's jeans. They fade. They fade and they wear out. So indigo on cotton is not as fast, and it's not a lasting color. On wool, it never fades. And today, we saw a beautiful example of tchelet not fading, which was this carpet, which is 2,500 years old, and was found in. I'm going to leave this here because you know what? It does have a tiny little tinge to it. This carpet was examined, the inside purple and the outside beautiful blue, sky blue border. You can't see it as well here. I have pictures that'll show it more exactly. That sky blue is made with the chemicals indigo and dibromo indigo that come out of a snail. And that's lasted for 2,500 years. So that's pretty impressive.
So blue jeans are made
with yes. I have one more thing to say, but I want to open it up first of all to any kind of questions first.
What happens to the cloth on the
the cloth that was found on Masada, that Yigal Yadin found and brought to Sidney Adelstein, was made out of a mixture of indigo from a plant and red dye. So it was a purple-blue cloth, but it was not made out of murex. Now, how do you know if you've got something that's 2,500 years old, whether it was made out of plant indigo or whether it was made out of indigo that came from a snail or what it's made out of? And the answer is that even though the Gemara says it's impossible for anybody to know the difference between kala ilan, which is plant indigo, and real tchelet, which is the blue that would come out of a snail, right? Modern technology is able to tell the difference. Because what comes out of a snail, I've been using these words, it has dibromo indigo as well as indigo. Okay, this is an indigo molecule. This is an indigo molecule. This is wrong. Okay. This is wrong. I don't know who made this. This is terrible. This X should be off of here and off of here. In these positions. If in these positions you have hydrogen, you're going to get indigo, which is blue, the color of the sky. If in these positions you have bromine, you're going to get dibromo indigo, which is Tyrian purple, which gives you a red purple. And if you have one bromine, then you're going to get a bluish red purple. So in the snail, you have dibromo indigo, which is red purple, monobromo indigo, which is a little bit bluish purple, and you also have a little bit of indigo, which is just sky blue. And that's in every snail. If you expose this, as we would have done, to sunlight, the bromine bonds are going to break, and you're going to be left with just indigo, which is pure blue. However, as with all chemical reactions, nothing is 100%. And so you're still going to have little traces of brominated molecules in there. So if you take, let's say, a good mass spectrometer or liquid chromatography, and you, you know, high-performance HPLC or something like that, you can actually see that there are still some bromine molecules left, brominated molecules left, in something that comes from a snail that had come from a snail originally. If you don't find any brominated molecules, you know it came from a plant. So what Yigal Yadin did is when he sent this to Edelstein, Edelstein said, there's no brominated molecules, it's coming from a plant. However, and I just want to end your question with this, Yigal Yadin was, as you can see, this is the kind of thing that Yigal Yadin must have felt when it ended up that Edelstein told him that this didn't come from a plant, that didn't come from a snail. Because he actually wrote that this was real tchelet, real tzitzis, and he had found them, and he discovered them, and he writes all about it, and then he was completely disproven, and he retracted it, and he said, you know what, I thought it was real tzitzis, I didn't find tchelet, I thought I found it, but, and he really had to double take. And he had written in his articles, in the 1965 articles, he really spent a lot of time saying, this is the most important find, because it's real tzitzis, and da-da-da. But not all of the finds were investigated as Yigal Yadin found them. On Masada and then also in the Ein Bokeh caves, as with most archaeological sites, what you really do, the archaeologists take all of the stuff and they tag it and bag it and they throw it in a drawer so that one day somebody else who's going to do their doctorate or master's is going to come and pull it out of the drawer and he's going to tell you something very, very important. But there's no way that you can examine all of the stuff that you find right away. And one small little scrap of fabric was left in a drawer in the Rockefeller Museum. Since 1965, when Yigal Yadin first tagged it, and didn't even know about it, probably, in the Ein Bokeh cave, and just now, in 2011, was examined by Professor Tzvi Koren, also from the Shankar College. This is a small little scrap that was found on Masada. It was just announced in 2011 that that little beautiful piece of blue comes from a snail, from the Murex truncus snail. It has its dibromo indigo in it, the trace elements of it. So in fact, Yigal Yadin actually did find real tchelet. He just died too early to know that he had found it. Yeah. That's dark blue, yeah. Well, you can get dark blue, first of all, by putting a little bit more of a concentration in it. The question that is asked, and there is no really way to answer this question, is was tchelet light blue or was it dark blue? It depends. I mean, if you put a little bit more dye in, you could get a very, very dark blue. If you don't put enough dye in, you get a really, really light blue. So there's no way to answer that question, and that's actually, I think, a machloket between Rashi and the Rambam. The Rambam says that tchelet is the color of the sky in the middle of the day. And Rashi, at one point, says that tchelet is mashchirin le'et erev, the sky as it gets dark towards the end of the evening. Towards evening time, towards the end of the day. It's growing. We produce about 1,200. We did about in 2012. We did about 1,200 sets. 12,000 sets. 12,000 sets, right? In 2011, right? No, we get our snails from Croatia. We have a bunch of fishermen who pull the snails up, and we have a lovely guy named Renato who organizes all of the fishermen and gets all the snails. Now, they catch the snails, strangely enough, exactly the same way that they did 2,000 years ago. Pliny writes how they used to catch the snails 2,000 years ago. No. This is the way you catch murex snails. Murex are carnivorous snails. They'll eat meat, and they'll even eat each other. These fascinating little snails have this little proboscis that drips hydrochloric acid, and they can actually make a little tiny little hole in another snail, and they can paralyze it and turn it over and eat the meat, right? And if there are no other snails around, they'll eat each other. So if you find these murex shells with tiny little bore holes in them, you know that they were in captivity because they ate each other, because there's a little hole in it. And in fact, in Dor, there are these holding pens, and they were the supposition is that these little pens under the water level were used when they would collect the snails. They would put them into these pens. Some of the snails that were found there have these little telltale bore holes, so that corroborates it. And why did they have to collect the snails and put them in these holding pens? Because the snail has to be alive when you do the dyeing with it. So they would hold them and keep them alive until it was time to do it. So what you do is you put a little bit of meat into these baskets, drop them into the water for a day or two, and then pick them up, and you'll find all of these little snails on them and pull them off. And you get 50 to 100 snails every time you do this. Take that with maybe 300 or 400 fishermen working on it for a couple of days, and you get, you know, maybe 50,000 to 100,000 snails, which is what we take when we get a shipment. Renato knows how to break them open, take out the gland, and dry them all off for us, and we get just the dried snail shells, maybe 20 kilo at a time. Why does it have to be alive? Why does it have to be alive? The precursor of the dye, which can turn into the dye, is what exists inside the snail. In order for it to turn into the dye molecule of indigo or dibromo indigo, it needs two or three things. It's still an argument among biochemists, but at least it certainly needs oxygen, which is not present inside of the snail, and only when it comes out and you actually take it out and you slice it open, that's when it's exposed to oxygen. It probably needs sunlight, although that's the argument. And it needs one more thing, which is an enzyme called purpurase. That enzyme is found inside of the snail, but it decomposes very, very quickly when the snail dies. So the purpurase, which will go away within hours, if you don't have that, you'll get this very, very weak, gray, ugly dye, very similar to what this would come out with. And that can happen. So you have to take the snail, and you have to basically take the gland out of the snail exactly when it's alive. And the Gemara and Shabbos talks about that. It's psik resha. If you're going to kill the snail to get the dye, the snail is going to be killed. But then the Gemara says, no, but it's a psik resha de lo nichale. You don't want it to die. And the Gemara says, why don't you want the snail to die? Kama de itbe nafish nichatfe. The more alive it is, the better it is for the dye. You know, the first time that I found these snails in Greece, we used to get our snails from Greece originally. And I ordered a huge shipment, which was enough for maybe 100, 200, I don't know how many tzitzis that we could make. So the guy from Greece called me up and he said, you know, that's a lot of snail, right? He goes, I can't give that to you all the time. He said, I can maybe get you that much once a week. So that's a lot of snails, once a week, because they eat them all along the coast. And they've been eating them for many, 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 many years, huge amounts of them. And they're not extinct, and they're not going extinct. These are pretty robust snails, and they really are all over the Mediterranean. If the time comes when Klal Yisrael and Am Yisrael decide in mass, Mirtz Hashem, in our days, to wear Tehillah, and somebody wants to donate a couple of $1 million to make a snail farm, we can name that after somebody. Have a big plaque.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Wait, hold on 1 second. Yeah. We're trying to work on that more and more. There are a lot of places that you can get them. You can get them online in our places. Look, one of the big problems, it's not so much getting the strings, it's how do you tie it. See, I talked about this the other... do I have it? Yeah, okay. You know, halacha is a great thing, and like everything in the world, halacha is subject to natural selection. So you've got a Gemara, and the Gemara has all these principles, and then you have the Rishonim, the Rambam, and the Rashba, and the Rush, and the Ravid, and all of these other people who give you the Tosfot and Rashi, who tell you this is the way to do it. And you have many, many, many shitot on everything, many, many different opinions. And then you have this process of 1,000 or 1,500 years of getting to one thing that we all do, right? You know, because, like with everything, there's a momentum. A few people start to follow Tosfos Shita on this or the Rashba's Shita on that, and then everybody else follows along, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins the way the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, and then the Ramah Paskins and the Rishonim and the Achronim, and you get to one thing. And if you look around the shul, you'll see pretty much that almost everybody in the shul, probably in Toronto, everybody in Toronto, wears exactly the same shita on how to tie white. Right? But what happened with Tehelet is that at the times of the Rishonim, that process ended. And all you have are the shitot of the Rishonim. And we don't have that 1,000 years now of figuring out exactly what we all do. So you have everything from the Radziner Zari to the Teimanim in the Rambam to the left, and the Ravid, the beautiful Ravid in Rav Natro Naigon in his barbershop stripe next to it, the Shitot of the Chinuch and the Gra, Rav Amram Gaon, Tosfot, and there's more. And there's people that are coming up with more and more. I just had a referral to a paper that came out in one of the places in Bar Ilan where a person invented a completely new shita based on his understanding of the Gemara. So there's all of this problem now in how to tie it. So you ask your question, is it available? Yes, it's available. How do you tie it? It's a hard question. We don't want to make that determination. We're not Rabbanim. Rav Tevger has his shita, but we don't want to paskin on how to tie it. So that becomes a problem. I hope that we can find some people around that will learn how to tie, and then, that'll be available. It is absolutely available in North America. I hope that we can get it being sold here in Toronto and being available here in Toronto. There are three arguments against wearing our tchelet. Argument number one is that they're not convinced that this is real. Okay, and I've made the story here, and I think that it's a little bit of a convincing story. I can make the argument a lot more convincing. I can show you that there are absolute proofs that in the time of Chazal, they knew about these snails. Right? And I think that we can make the argument... I don't even have the picture. There is a picture of a snail that was found on Har Tzion from the times of the Beit HaMikdash in an area that was lived in by Kohanim. There is, in my opinion, there's absolutely no way that you can say that Chazal in the time of the Gemara and the Mishnah didn't know about these snails. You saw from Masada that they knew how to dye with a blue dye. So I think that the argument is strong, but there are those that are not convinced, and they think that the argument is not convincing. Perfectly legitimate, and that's one reason not to wear our tchelet. Second reason not to wear our tchelet is that even though you think that the arguments would be convincing, but you don't accept the evidence, because archaeology and history and science are not admissible in the court of halacha, in the Bet Din. Don't tell me anything about what archaeologists found. Show me some Gemara somewhere or Medrash or something that I can live with, but I can't accept anything else outside that. And the bottom line is, the Gemaras are not conclusive. The Gemaras are not conclusive whether they were intentionally left vague, whether they were left vague because maybe the people in the Gemara didn't have access to the information that the dyers had access to, or for whatever reason, the information in the Gemara is absolutely not convincing one way or another. There are many things in Gemara that fit what we say, and there are many things in the Gemara in other places that don't fit. The Zohar talks about the fact that the Chilazon is found in the Yam HaKineret, right? Doesn't fit. There's nothing you can do. If you want to argue that that is, you know, is legitimate, then absolutely fine. So if you're tying our hands behind our back and you're saying we can't introduce anything, archaeology, history, science, argue on the basis of these Gemaras, there's room for the ability to say that this Tchelet is not convincing or it's not real. The third reason has nothing to do with the question of whether this is real Tchelet or not, and whether this is genuine Chilazon or not. And the Briskers, starting with Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and including Rav Lichtenstein today, well, especially Rav Lichtenstein, he's the most the classic example. Rav Lichtenstein says, this is real Tchelet, it's the legitimate Chilazon, it's 100% accurate that this is what Tchelet was. However, we don't wear it today because the line of tradition has been broken. And if tradition has been broken, there is no way to reestablish a halacha. And this is a very interesting opinion. I'm not capable of presenting it as well as I'm sure Lichtenstein or somebody else would be able to present it, but it is absolutely a shita which many, many people ascribe to. I think Rabbi Willig would accept that shita. And so there are many, many people, and people from YU and people from that community, which say, as long as the tradition has been broken, authenticity is not the issue, tradition is the issue. And Rabbi Shachter doesn't hold from that.
And along the lines, we spoke about this on Shabbos. Rav Shachter, I've heard him say more than once, he holds this as unbelievable. You're not allowed to wear tzitzis this man of Tzitzis without a tailor. It's usher to wear tzitzis without a tailor. That's what he holds. And then you might have more to do. Because since we have the ability to wear tailor, and you don't, it's a problem on both people. You're violating the prohibition of the Torah to detract from the mitzvah of Balkosis and both people.
I will say this. There are many, many rabbanim There are not many rabbanim who are actually against our tchelet. There are many rabbanim who don't take it seriously, who don't address it. There are many rabbanim who, you know, it's an interesting kind of a thing. Like Rav Lichtenstein is an example. Rav Lichtenstein doesn't wear our tchelet. One of his sons, Rav Meir, does wear tchelet. Rav Avadia Yosef doesn't wear our tchelet. One of his sons, Rav Yaakov, does wear tchelet. Many of the older generation, for whatever reason, are less or more conservative and less willing to accept. But many of the middle generation, younger generation, are absolutely accepting it. If you go to Eretz Yisrael now and you look at the Rosh Yeshivot, certainly of the Hezder Yeshivot, Rav Drori, Rav Dov Lior, Rav Sherlo, Rav Ariel in Ramat Gan, Rav Yoshua Shapira, and on and on, Rav Reima Kohen, and so on. You have so many people of the younger generation of Rabbanim who are absolutely in favor of wearing Tchelet, and you have even peaks in the Haredi community here and there. There's a bunch of people in Lakewood who wear Tchelet, and a bunch of people in Mir. Rav Belsky from Torah Vadas wears Tchelet. So there, here and there, there's even in the Hasidic community. There's a Magid Shir in Bells who recently in Yerushalayim has started giving shiurim and telling people that they should wear Tchelet, and you have a number of Hasidim here and there. We have some Hasidim in Karlin. You have Hasidim here and there that are starting to wear it. So it's something that's catching on, and it'll catch on. It'll catch on very slowly, but hopefully it'll consistently catch on. Yes. So you asked about 7 years. I can only quote from Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog had this problem with anything, and I guess we'll finish up. Rav Herzog had this problem about the once in 70 years. And like I said before, there are a number of Gemaras that are very, very difficult to understand. That once in 70 years Gemaras has at least 7 or 8 variations in different manuscripts in different places. Once in 70 years, once in 7 years, once in 6 years, once in a blue moon, it comes up. That's a Tosefta that the Rambam quotes, but he doesn't quote that particular part of the Tosefta. In the place of that Tosefta, the Rambam brings down instead, Uviyam HaMelach Hu Matsui. Now the Rambam says that it's found in the Yam HaMelach. Now the Rambam didn't mean the Yam HaMelach the way we mean the Yam HaMelach. He meant the salty seas, and often the Rambam uses the Mediterranean, he calls it the Yam HaMelach. So when the Gemara says it comes up once every 7 or 70 years, the question is, where is it all the rest of the time? And so the Rambam interpreted the inverse of that, if you will, the converse, which is, it comes up once every 70 years, the rest of the time it's found in the ocean. I don't buy that personally too well. I think that I don't know I would rather leave it as I don't know the answer to it. I can say this, and with this I'll end, and I think that this is a very, very, very important point. And I would say if I had 5 minutes with a Rabbanim who are against our Tchelet, this is the point that I would make, and I'll make it in 1 minute instead of five. Both Rav Herzog and the Radziner pare down everything to 2, possibly 3 absolutely important criteria for a kosher chilazon. And that is, 1, it has to come from a sea creature. 2, it has to be a sky blue color. And then the 3rd, it has to be steadfast and not fade. Both Radziner and Rav Herzog say, if you find anything which meets those 3 criteria, it has to be kosher for Tchelet, and they give their logical reason for that. And so interesting that both of them come to the same conclusion. These are the 2 people in the last 150 years who have researched the halachot of Tchelet more than probably everyone else together. And they both come to the exact same conclusion. Those 3 things are important. It could be that there are many things that meet that criteria. But if you find any of those, they will be kosher. It could be that there's only 1. But if you find something that's a sea creature, it gives you a sky blue color. And that sky blue color does not fade. It has to be kosher for Tchelet. On that basis, I think that it's absolutely clear, and no one can argue with it, that this Murex trunculus would be kosher for Tchelet. Was it the only chilazon? Is it the authentic chilazon? I can't say for 100% sure, but I can say that both according to Radziner and Rav Herzog, this would be kosher for Tchelet. And you can argue with them, by the way. You can say, I don't agree with Rav Herzog. It has to be a fish. It has to come up once every 70 years. It has to be in the Kinneret. You can give other things, but at least Rav Herzog and the Radziner would both agree that this chilazon should be kosher. I thank you so much for your time, and went way over. But I apologize again on behalf of the snail who was just not cooperative.